This was Jeannie's favorite song in all the world.
Sampling day to day with you is tasting joy, feeling new, making peace an easier thing to do. Being whole is my natural state, my beautiful fate with you. Before you came, my life was lost, all loving still, unfulfilled, never knowing what my heart was saying, never praying. Oh, what a dismal world I lived in.
My Beautiful Fate With You, written and sung and played by Jeannie's sister Kathleen Rubico, who currently conducts Dionne Warwick's orchestra. I can't tell you how many times I heard Jeannie humming it to herself whenever she was feeling especially blessed. It is therefore one of the most joyous songs I know. And that makes it the perfect song to open this podcast, for I have extremely joyous news to impart. Gather round, my friends. If you've seen the homepage of my website, spiderrobinson.com, in the last couple of months, you'll be aware that last November I went to visit my daughter, Terry Luana Da Silva, and her family in Ohio, and happened to arrive the night before she was diagnosed with what turned out to be stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. Perhaps you've been following her subsequent adventures with chemotherapy in her excellent blog at www.gracefulwomanwarrior.com. And if so, you already know the happy news, so I'll just get on with it. Terry just completed her first round of chemotherapy. How was it? Well, let Lord Buckley describe it.
He said, "Your most royal swinging majesty, I've been on a lot of sad tours. I've been on a lot of mad beat, bent up, down, gridden excursions. I've been on a lot of tilted picnics and a lot of double unhung parties." He said, "I suffered from pavement rash. I've been bent, twisted, spent, de-gigged, flipped, trapped, and babapped. But," he said, "I never was so drunk in my whole life like I was with this here last gig you put me on." He said, "It was rough. It was double rough."
But my graceful woman warrior is double tough. Read her blog, you'll see. So she just completed round one of chemo, and naturally they wanted to know how much good, if any, that particular combination of poisons had done. So they scoped her and scanned her and imaged her and bled her, and the results are now in. The original two tumors in her breast have shrunk more than 80% each. All the other metastasized tumors in all her lymph nodes, a leg bone, and other places, they're gone. They can't find them no more. She is still stage 4 metastatic and will always be. Once a cancer metastasizes, the assumption is that it will again. But at the moment, she's just this side of in remission. In light of this new information, they have decided not to give her a double mastectomy after all, nor do they now anticipate using radiation. She'll just need careful watching and regular, expensive, and dangerous chemo at intervals for the rest of her life. But at the moment, her and her own's biggest problem is paying the massive bills for all that chemo and all those scans and tests she's already had. A benefit concert in New Bedford, Massachusetts last month, organized by Jeannie's sisters and several of Terry's oldest friends, raised a healthy piece of money. Terry and I both attended, by Skype. And a second benefit concert is being held for her here on Bowen Island on May 26th at the Legion Hall, featuring most of Bowen's best musicians and special auction items donated by Graham Nash, David Crosby, and other celebs. That should help some. It's being organized by all the friends Terry made while she and her own were living here on Bowen, helping Jeannie and me cope. If you can't make it to the Legion Hall come the 26th, you can always visit www.gracefulwomanwarrior.org and drop a few coins in the hat, or contact Blessed Jen Schroeder at jenmschroeder@aol.com for the latest updates on the eBay auctions she is running on Terry's behalf, just as she did for Jeannie and me a couple of years ago. To summarize, my daughter has kicked cancer's ass. With diet, exercise, meditation, positive visualization, a bit of Reiki, and above all, attitude. See her inspirational blog for details. That's gracefulwomanwarrior.com. Her doctors had assured her none of that stuff would help in the least. Now they are, well, gobsmacked. Me too. Let there be joy everywhere as far as this pod can cast it. Terry Da Silva, wife of Heron, mother of Marissa Alegria, daughter of Jeannie and me, is well. Oh my God, I can barely see for tears. Jeannie must be so relieved. It is just now washing over me exactly how scared I was. I had been keeping the full knowledge from myself. My shoulders have dropped an inch. I get more air in each breath. For the first time in a long while, my writing is beginning to flow again, slowly but well. You all know my mantra. Shared pain is lessened, shared joy is increased. Please share my joy. And thanks to all of you who have sent money or prayed or just held a good thought. It's so nice to have good news for you. Been a while. May all cancer patients and their loved ones be granted as much good fortune as Terry as soon as possible. Long past time that disease was sent to join smallpox. Too much talk, not enough music. Here come two in a row from yet another of the countless musical incarnations of my friend Doug Cox, who has more lives than a cloned cat. This one is called Strung, and consists of Doug on dobro, Tony McManus on guitar, April Virch on violin, and Cody Walter on bass. First, you'll hear them do a Doug Cox composition called Frog Pond Holler, followed by Maybe in the Morning. Thank you.
to see you in the morning crying, Daddy, why'd you leave me all alone? Don't want to see you missing all those special things that someday you'll be needing on your own. Then maybe in the morning we'll awake and find the dew shining like a diamond, just the way that you want it to. Then maybe somehow morning will arrange a change, and then I'll never have to go away again. I'll never have to go away again.
All these years I've waited for the sun to shine upon a better life for you and me. Hearing the children's laughter, drowning out the sadness that this world has given me to see.
Then maybe in the morning we'll awake and find the dew
shining like a diamond, just the way that you want it to.
Then maybe somehow morning we'll arrange a change, and then
I'll never have to go away again.
I'll never have to go away again. So often fall because we don't respect the feelings of someone who can hurt just like you do. Come lay them on my shoulder, we will talk about tomorrow's. I'll hold you in my arms the whole night through. Then maybe in the morning we'll awake and find the dew shining like a diamond, just the way that you want it to. Then maybe somehow morning will arrange a change, and then I'll never have to go away again. I'll never have to go away again. No, baby, I'll never have to go away again.
Strung's album Band of Gypsies can be found with a little work at Amazon.com and with consummate ease at CDBaby.com, which will also let you download it as MP3, even if you're not an American. Now, here's what Wikipedia says is one of the two African-American string bands left in all the world, carrying on the tradition of Joe Thompson, who caught a cab at age 93 on March 1st. Rest in peace, Joe. Unfortunately, Wikipedia omits to name the other African-American string band, and Google has failed me for once. If you can hip me who the other group is, I'd be obliged. But here's the one I know about and have lately wigged out over. Dom Flemons, Rhiannon Giddens, Adam Matta, and Hubby Jenkins, collectively known as the Carolina Chocolate Drops. They've opened for Taj Mahal and for Bob Dylan, and they have a song called Daughter's Lament on the soundtrack album for The Hunger Games. Here they are performing live on Later with Jules Holland, the Carolina Chocolate Drops, with a song by an extremely happy woman called No Man's Mama.
Carolina Chocolate Drops.
For the longest while, got a big load off my mind. Here's the paper sealed and signed. And the judge was nice and kind all through the trial. This ends the 5-year war. I am myself once more. I can go where I please, I can come where I please, I can flit, fly, and flutter like the birds in the trees, because I'm no man's mama now. Hey, hey, I can say what I like, I can do what I like. I'm a gal who is on a matrimonial strike, which means I'm no man's mama now. I'm screaming there, know how a fella feels getting out of jail. I've got twin beds and I take pleasure in announcing one's for sale. Am I making it plain? I will never again drag around another ball and chain, because I'm no man's mama now. I don't have to worry what my hubby will think, because I'm no man's mama now. Are you getting what I'm telling you? I can spend what I choose, I can play, sing the blues, and there's nobody messing with my ones and my twos, because I'm no man's mama now. I'll tell you there was the time I used to think that men were grand. Well, no more for mine. I've gone and labeled my apartment no man's land. I got rid of my cat, cause the cat's name was Pat. Don't even have a mailbox in my flat, because I'm no man's mama now. Am I making it plain? I will never again drag around another ball and chain, because I'm no man's mama now.
I should have mentioned that on that number, the part that might traditionally have gone to a washtub bass was instead gorgeously played by cellist Layla McCalla. The Carolina Chocolate Drops' last record, the Genuine Negro Jig, was not only number one on the bluegrass charts, it won the Grammy for Best Traditional Folk Album. They've just released a new one called Leaving Eden. I'm going to read you some science fiction in just a few minutes, but before I do, I want to swivel a short little riff on you about one of the many ways the internet is so damn wonderful. I just downloaded from dimeadozen.org a set by Ella Fitzgerald and Ray Brown's Quintet. It ain't for sale anywhere, but a collector decided to share one of his treasures with the world. This particular session was broadcast live from the Royal Roost in New York City on November 27th, 1948. That, I've been told, was the day my mom got me home from the hospital, also in New York City. She was a serious jazz fan, so I'm sure she would have had the radio on that night. I don't believe hospitals had Muzak in 1948, thank God, so there is an excellent chance that the following was the very first music I ever heard. And if so, I can see the smile on my mother's face as she realized what song it was.
He's the chick's private enjoy. Got a knocked out style with a cutest smile. Love that boy. He's got those baby brown eyes and those flashy bow ties. He's the king of the hoi polloi. Don't know what he's got, but he's got a lot. Love that boy. He's a graduate from a fashion plate. All the chicks think that he's a righteous gent. They would nominate him for chief of state, but he'd rather be righteous than be president, 'cause he is what he is, the technique is all his. He's a wriggle McCoy. Don't you hear me state? I'll reiterate, love that boy. From the tip of his toe to the tip of his nose, he's a chick's pride and joy. Play pretty for the people, Hank. I love that boy. With his baby brown eyes and his flashy bold eyes, he's the king of the heart full of joy. Oh, how I love that boy. He's a graduate from a fashion place. All the chicks think he's a righteous gent. They would nominate him for chief of state, but he'd rather be righteous than be president, 'cause he is what he is, the technique is all his. He's the Wiggle McCoy. Don't you hear me say, I'll be in her babe. Don't you hear me say, I'll be in her babe, 'cause I love her. How I love her, that boy. How I love her. How I love that boy. How I love that boy.
As an infant, I was known for my flashy ties. The Hank Ella exhorts in that track is the great Hank Jones, the man who was playing piano while Marilyn sang Happy Birthday, Mr. President to JFK. Hank left the party almost a year ago at the age of 91, and he was gigging till the end. An unbelievable career. Which reminds me to congratulate and thank my own father, Charles Robinson, who turned 90 a couple of months ago and is in excellent health in all respects. Way to go, Dad. Go, Cat, go. I regret to report his wife Joan is presently in somewhat less excellent health and could use your prayers or good thoughts if you can spare a few. Now I'm going to read you the prologue of a book by a writer you should have encountered decades ago, and I have absolutely no idea why you didn't. Nor is he by any means the only glaring error on the part of the publishing industry I happen to know about. I've never actually done the research, way too much like work. But I'll bet if you polled published writers, almost every single one of us would turn out to know at least a few people who not only can write very well, but have written very well, and yet inexplicably have somehow never succeeded in breaking into print. This despite, or perhaps for all I know, because of our persistent attempts to persuade editors to read them. Very frustrating. And here's a classic example. I've known Seymour Hamilton almost as long as Jeannie. Indeed, he was one of the most industrious, ingenious, and inventive supporters of her dance company, Nova Dance Theater, a member of its board of directors back in the 70s. He and I, in fact, actually performed on stage together, as non-dancers, in one of Jeannie's early pieces. And so, now that I recall it, did my daughter Terry. If memory serves, the piece was titled Rectocranial Inversion. A diabolically handsome and cultured and witty man is Seymour, with a truly magnificent beard. Ever since I've known Seymour Hamilton, I've been expecting him to break into print at any moment. God knows why he didn't. To my knowledge, he did everything right and kept on doing it. I certainly recommended him to every editor I knew. He was ready back in the 70s, a born storyteller. Now, at age 71, he has finally sold a splendid, sprawling saga he began back then, the Estrella Trilogy. Hallelujah! I'm not really sure exactly how to classify it, science fiction or fantasy or science fantasy. I suppose it depends on whether you feel it takes place in the far future or the distant past, and that's entirely up to you. It meets my own definition of science fiction, but I'll be the first to admit my definition is so elastic you could bungee jump from high orbit on it. Who cares what category it fits best? It's a good and timeless story about a man of the sea and where the sea takes him. As it says in the About the Author at the back of all three books, Seymour Hamilton is from a seagoing family going back many generations. He first learned to sail a dinghy from his father, who, like his grandfather, was a master mariner and commander in the British Navy. You can find all three volumes of the Astraea Trilogy on Amazon.com or by visiting AstraeaTrilogy.com. That's AstraeaTrilogy.com. Or I suppose you could always go direct to its publisher, FireshipPress.com. It got some rave customer reviews on Amazon, only one of which I wrote. I used to read Jeannie to sleep, and Astraea's is a story I know she would have enjoyed from start to finish. And here is how Astraea Book 1, The Voyage South, begins. Prologue. If you are in a hurry to get on with Astraea's story, you can skip the prologue and go to Chapter 1. But if you do jump ahead, you'll find yourself wondering where Astraea came from and why he was not like everyone else. Ancient, round-shouldered mountains met the sea only a little south of where winter held the ocean ice-clad the whole year long. Along the coastline, where harbors were few and hard to find, jagged rocks combed the breakers, grinding at shards of wood that might once have been ships. A double handful of small, blunt-bowed fishing boats worked their way across the wind toward a gap in the cliffs that only they knew was there. As each boat rose to the crest of a wave, the men aboard sometimes caught a glimpse of their companions' hulls, but more often they saw only dark sails, wind-bent on the same course. As they drew closer to land, the deep-throated roar of breakers on the cliffs drowned the skipper's shouts when they turned downwind to thread a needle's eye of broken water between black headlands silhouetted against the evening sky. For a tense moment, each boat hung on the wave that its skipper had chosen to surf through the narrow gap. Then, one by one, they rode the breakers between the headlands and were suddenly out of both wind and waves and only needed to avoid a tidal whirlpool before they were into protected water. Ahead of them was a bay the shape of a man's hand, with four narrow fjords like splayed fingers probing the forested mountainsides that fell steeply into the dark water below. The boats turned south into the fifth and broadest of the fjords where the mountains drew back, leaving a somewhat gentler slope where the fishermen had lived for so many generations that the first settlers had long been forgotten. Within the shadow of the encircling highlands, the fishing boats eased through calm water, black as the rocky heights above. They slid towards the wooden wharves of the village, heading for their allotted places, furling their homemade sails as they went. Where a stream made its final downhill rush into the salty bay, bait shacks and boathouses stood half on land, half on wooden pilings driven into the rocky bottom. As they neared the shore, the men glanced up at their cottages of stone and weathered gray wood that looked over each other's rooftops down to the water's edge. Smoke from the chimneys rose almost straight up into the evening air until it escaped the lee of the sheltering cliffs, briefly caught the last light, and was swept away by the wind. It was near nightfall in the village when the fleet was secured and the crews went ashore. Orange light from oil lamps spilled into the darkness as doors opened to receive the sailors home. Inshore, higher than the last semicircle of dwellings, the stream chuckled over stones as it left the forest. There, high above the village, within the sound of running water, was a level space where the village cemetery grew a little larger every year to make room for the winter's dead. Higher still, the rocky crest was a black line against the twilight sky. In the shadows, where gravestones outnumbered the people living in the village below, there were more markers in the ground than there had been bodies carried up the hill. "Lost at sea," repeated like a melancholy chorus echoing down the years, each of which had seen the little boat sail out of the harbor onto the ocean, some never to return. If the fate of most men of the village was to follow the sea until it caught them, the role of women was equally circumscribed. Their lot was to become a sailor's wife and, too often, his widow. Some would live to see their grandchildren, some would die bringing another sailor into the world, or perhaps a woman destined to tend house and wait hopefully for her seafaring husband's return. However, the sea yielded fish, and the forest grew wood for boats in which to take the catch, and for most of the villagers there was security and even some contentment in knowing their fate. They were untroubled by the rest of the world, which had long forgotten them. Daily life within the cycle of the seasons was enough. Few wondered about what might be away, or what could have happened before, since none of them knew the answers. Their lives were not easy, but because they depended on each other in times of hardship, they also shared the brief moments of joy. There were always songs in the village, and dancing as well, both when the men came home and for practice while they were away. Singers could rhyme the night away with so many songs to stir body and spirit that a tune was seldom repeated unless someone insisted on a reprise. There were songs of love, of longing, and of lovers parted by the sea. There were joking songs that grew longer with the doings of villagers past and present, songs of mourning, and songs whose origin and meaning were obscure. Of all the singers in the village, none sang so sweetly as Alanna. Unlike most of the villagers who were sturdy and fair or red-haired, she was tall and slim, with long hair as brown and shiny as a freshly peeled nut. Her eyes were by some lights blue, by others almost green. Alanna grew from a thin, willowy girl blessed only with a voice, to a young woman who stood somewhat apart from the rest of the village. Perhaps because her life had been darkened by the death of both her parents when she was young, there was a touch of sadness in the way she went about her life in an uncle's house, quietly helping her aunt with four children young enough to be her own nieces and nephews. Young men sometimes sighed for Alanna, but they did not approach her. She was as much a part of their lives as the stream that ran through the village, but she remained remote as its source in the forested mountains. They were all touched by the richness of her voice and the simple elegance with which she sang. When she was called upon to sing the long and difficult laments so much loved by the older folk of the village, many of the men wiped the corners of their eyes, and women wept openly. When she sang of love, the young men's hearts were inflamed, and yet even the most boisterous of them became tongue-tied and awkward in her presence. One evening, as she was watching the fleet return on the evening tide, a black-haired stranger was carried from the last boat. The skipper, Roaring Jack, Alanna's uncle by marriage, had seen the man's dismasted and rudderless skiff being tossed by an onshore wind towards the cliffs, and it was Scar-Arm Ian, known as Skarm, who had hauled the castaway almost lifeless from the sea. At first the villagers thought the stranger dumb, or so shocked by his ordeal that he had lost the power of speech. Skarm, whose wife had died in childbirth many years before, cared for the sailor in his own cottage. The healers visited them daily, taking care of him despite his long black hair and dark complexion, so different from their own. When days passed into weeks, and he was able to walk down to the village wharf where all could see him, it was apparent that he could speak, though with an accent and intonation different from the plain talk of the village. With Skarm's help, he soon learned to understand and make himself understood, but he remained economical with words, even compared to sailors who spoke only when there was good reason for it. The villagers called him Stranger, since that was close enough the outlandish name he offered them.
"'Twould be a fine thing if you could tell us from whence he came," remarked one of his crewmates, Red Ian, so named to distinguish him from his uncle, Scar-Arm Ian.
"He has more to say than my relatives in the cemetery," said Skarm, "but not by a lot."
In fact, Skarm knew more than he told. He kept the stranger's secrets because much of what he had heard were the whisperings and mutterings of someone at the edge of consciousness making his way back to life. Skarm's silence was not difficult to maintain, because he was the keeper of many secrets and had the habit of guarding his tongue. He kept the village's born and buried book, which among other things recorded who was related to whom, particularly when neither was wed to the other. He approved the relationships that he judged to be sufficiently separated, and discreetly ensured that nobody inadvertently married a half-brother or sister. His own secret was a collection of books from both away and before, that dated from a time when ships visited the village regularly, coming across the seas and oceans, voyaging far from sight of land. Skarm and the stranger soon recognized that neither gossiped. And so Skarm answered questions about the village and its families, and gave the stranger leave to read as he wished, even within the Born and Buried book, where he had encoded much more than its name suggested. Even though the villagers did not accept the stranger as one of their own, they approved when he fitted into the village's work without friction or disturbance, first helping with the mending of nets and boats, then joining the village boys as they fished for bait in the fjord, and then, as he recovered strength, taking a place in the boat that had rescued him. Roaring Jack took him aboard the Molly, where after a week's fishing, the big-voiced skipper declared, "He's handy." The few who did not hear Roaring Jack's approval knew his judgment in less than a day. As the weeks passed, the mothers, aunts, and the grandmothers of the village conducted their own appraisal of the stranger whenever they met for weaving, sewing, and gossip. Though the stranger and Alanna were together no more than was explicable by the course of the day's work, their secret was revealed even before they knew it themselves. And after Roaring Jack's mother told her friends that she had seen Alanna and the stranger standing together much closer than was necessary for spreading fish on the drying racks, their love was hidden no longer. So it was that the quiet man, who seldom answered with more than the gleam of a smile, began to open his mind and heart to the young, green-eyed woman, speaking to her in a different way from his conversations with Skarm. And because of her own apartness from the unmarried women, she guarded every word he said to her. The season passed from fall to winter. The village made all secure against the storms, pulled the boats up on shore, and prepared to endure the snow and cold. Ice formed on the fjord, and spray froze onto the rocks at the harbor mouth. During the brief brightness of the midwinter feast, Alanna and the stranger began keeping company in the formal manner of the village. They sat together, danced, and stole glances as the village wives and grandmothers kept them decorously apart in the decent traditions handed down over the generations, an arrangement that let the villagers discuss the couple's every move. Gradually, the villagers began to see destiny in the union of the silent, black-haired man and the lonely young woman who sang. The two seldom spoke in the presence of others, but the couple's closeness warmed the hearts of those who remembered their own courtships, while the unmarried men envied at a distance too great for jealousy. When the last icicles dropped from the eaves, and the grass pushed up its green spears, the stranger and Alanna exchanged vows. At the wedding feast, everyone tried to remember his foreign-sounding name, but none could get his tongue around it. Skarm, who conducted the ceremony, tried to copy the strange sounds, but even though the stranger had written his name down for him, the best Skarm could do was Astrea. In the midst of the exchange of promises, the stranger slipped a silvery bracelet from his arm and put it on Alana's. The elders' disapproving stares silenced the whisper of questions and comments that followed, but they too were curious. During and after the feasting, singing, and dancing that followed, most of the villagers had something to say about the unusual marriage gift. When they asked Skarm what it might be, since he was the one who had had the best opportunity to see the shiny object, he only shrugged. Alanna was proud of the gift, but did not display it to the admiring group of wives of which she was now a member. They had to content themselves with glimpses of a silver band as wide as a man's three largest fingers, in which was a dark green stone caged in a curiously wrought setting. No one asked Alanna or Astrea directly, because even though their union had been duly blessed and approved by all, he still remained the stranger, and consequently she too was now estranged. All that spring and summer, when he went to sea, she never failed to climb to the headland at both his parting and return. When the little boats caught the morning wind and followed each other through the narrow passage between the headlands, she would stand on a rocky shelf below the clifftop, her shining hair blowing in the wind, one arm raised in farewell. Each evening, after the day's work was done, they walked home hand in hand. When he was ashore, the stranger worked to patch and strengthen a cottage that had stood empty for many years high above most of the village. Each time he returned, he found that Alanna had moved the work onward while he was away. By the end of summer, they moved into their new home together, where they completed the tasks of making it weathertight and well-stocked against the coming winter. When the storms struck and the snow lay knee-deep on each side of the trampled paths, they were happy together. The year turned through the short days and bitter nights until another spring returned, bringing with it the preparing of boats for the summer's fishing. When the little fleet first ventured forth to replenish larders empty except for a few leathery, salted fish, Alanna was on the headland to wave farewell. When all but one of the fleet returned, she walked to her cottage alone and silent. When the last boat appeared through the gap in the cliffs, the villagers heard a terrible scream in the twilight. Soon after, torches flickered on the stranger's body laid out on the wharf between the baskets of gleaming, silvery fish. A day later, when Alanna followed her husband's body to the cemetery, her once shining dark hair was streaked with white. Since all had suffered a similar loss, the villagers respected Alanna's grief. However, their sympathy waned as the months passed, and she showed no signs of abandoning her mourning and seeking a new husband. Those who came to share her sorrow were few, and when she would not rejoin the life of the village, she found herself alone. Accordingly, hardly anyone noticed that she carried the stranger's child until the birth was imminent. By chance, the year had seen an unusual number of pregnancies, so the midwife did not know Alana's condition until she was called to help with the delivery. She clucked her cheeks and shook her head because she had not been able to provide the charms and advice she gave the other expectant mothers in the village. Fortunately, Alana's solitary life had not harmed her, and she delivered a healthy son with hair as black as the stranger's and as curly as his had been straight. Alana's Aunt Molly, Roaring Jack's wife, was present at the birth and watched over mother and son with care and enthusiasm. The months passed, eventually exceeding the year that the village respected both as a time for recovery from childbirth and a proper period for mourning.
"Now," said the villagers, "she'll be sensible and find herself a man to be father to her child."
They encouraged the few widowers to court her, but Alana politely and firmly refused their suits. The villagers gossiped about this departure from time-honored tradition and her female duty to bring forth as many children as she was able. Some older women bent their gray heads together and whispered words like selfish and unwomanly. The men who had once watched and admired her now turned aside from Alana as she continued to refuse what all thought was her obvious destiny. Quietly, but with absolute finality, she ignored what everyone but she regarded as her obligation, and instead set about making herself indispensable to the village as a seamstress of such skill that even though all disapproved of her solitary way of life, they nonetheless respected her ability. When festivals, weddings, and funerals came, she was the first asked to prepare the dresses, and then to sing. Eventually, her independence was ignored because it had no cure. She named her son Astrea, after his father. She thereby earned the rebuke stranger from all those who could not pronounce it. As he grew, the villagers were civil to the boy they called Astrea. They were not vindictive folk, but they instinctively knew that he was not one of them, from his outlandish name to his angular face to his gray-green eyes and curly black hair. Whether of himself or from the solitary ways of his mother or because of the villagers' reaction to him, Astrea grew apart from the other children of his own age. As he grew up, Alana seldom spoke of the sea, as if she could somehow avert its threat by ignoring it. For her, the sea was both less and more fearsome than it seemed to the other women of the village. Less in that it had brought the stranger to be her husband, more in that it had taken him away again. She lived in fear that it would also take her son. That fear gave power to the songs she sang about the salt spray and the heave of waves that tore families apart. From her husband, Alana had heard of other destinations, other folk, different ways. She had kept his writings, even though she had never read what he wrote. Some of the more credulous women in the village might have been afraid of the sheets of paper and pressed birch bark on which the stranger had written and drawn. Others would have used the collection as a fire starter, unaware of its significance. A few might have held a more ceremonious bonfire. Death, fear, and the unknown were three strands of a dark rope that wound around the minds of almost all the villagers, tying them to the past. They clung to custom, lest they be overcome by terror of the sea that had torn sons, lovers, and husbands from every family. Though Alana was much more independent of thought and action than they, she was nonetheless one of them and thus affected by how they thought. Her compromise had been to keep her husband's writings unread in a leather-bound oaken box, where they were separate from her everyday life and that of her son. Year after year, as Astrea grew, the lid of the box stayed closed, and her memories of his father became colored by the villagers' increasingly distorted versions of the stranger's short sojourn with them. At first she tried to correct their impressions, and then she fell silent, then she avoided them all as much as possible and concentrated on raising her son. While the other mothers cared for and minded each other's babies and toddlers, Alanna kept Estrella apart. She knew that the older villagers saw the black-haired boy as different from their own sons, and so she avoided both their glances and whispers. The distance between her and the other mothers increased as the village children of his age began walking and talking, which meant that Estrella's infrequent meetings with other boys and girls were shaped by the behavior of their parents. The adults did not deliberately treat Estrella badly, but by drawing attention to the differences between him and other boys, they influenced their children, who turned looks into insults and words into bullying. When Estrella was 7, a dozen or so of the Smiths came down from the mountains where they mined and worked the metal needed by the village boats and homes, and the teasing took a new turn. The Smiths, who all seemed to be of the same family, were as black-haired as Estrella, though most of them were short and stocky. Unlike the village sailors in hair and skin color, their way of life was apparent in their clothes and habits as well. Where the village men stood tall and looked up to the sky and winds they dealt with every day, the Smiths were bent from digging underground and blackened from the charcoal with which they smelted iron into steel. Men and women alike wore leather clothes tanned almost black, and most were marked by fire or tattooed by fragments of ash and molten metal. The villagers traded with the Smiths for their iron and steel, but made a show of being sea-scrubbed clean by ostentatiously wiping their hands after each transaction. The Smiths accepted both the trading and the insults with stolid faces, but Estrella, who had snuck down to the shore out of curiosity, could see that their resentment closely resembled his own dislike of being singled out for teasing.
"So, Estrella, your folks are here," said one of the village sailors in a heavy-handed attempt at wit, and soon the joke had been repeated over and over. "You're going back up country with your family, Estrella. Are they glad to get rid of you?"
The question was offered in the presence of the Smiths themselves, as they set out their wares on the wharf, where skippers and wives alike could barter rope, cloth, and salt fish for knives, shackles, pots, and rowlocks. The eldest of the visitors stared at him, grunted something nobody understood, and turned away.
"See, Estrella? Nobody wants you. You're dirtier than a Smith," shouted a red-haired boy of Estrella's age.
A handful of village children picked up the chant,
"Dirty Smith, dirty Estrella, dirty Smith,"
and pushed him towards three of the younger Smiths who were boys on their first trip down from the mountains. They promptly pushed back, sending Estrella reeling back and forth from one group to the other until he had fallen and picked himself up several times. Eventually, parents on both sides ordered them all to stop, more out of annoyance than compassion. When Estrella came home, dirty and bruised, Alanna was not convinced by his reply. "It was just a game." When she pressed him for more details, something in Estrella would not let him complain. When she cautioned him against fighting, he took the advice to heart and determined that he would not react to taunting. But in the months and years that followed, whenever the slights and insults focused on her, it was too much for words or even silences, and he threw himself at even the largest of his tormentors. Time and again he returned with grazes, cuts, dirty clothes, and the same excuse in which neither of them believed. When Skarm saw that Estrella was being constantly bullied, he first tried to remonstrate with the mothers and fathers of the boys who were making the boy's life miserable. When this proved ineffective, he realized that in saving Estrella the father, he had also incurred a duty towards Estrella the son. Skarm knew that to intervene directly would lead to more bullying as soon as he was out of sight, so he looked for another way, and found one that solved a problem of his own. Skarm's injured arm had worsened with the years until it kept him from pulling his weight at sea. Determined to be useful, he began the task of teaching the village lads and girls how to read a little, how to write at least their names, and to count enough to reckon the day's catch, if boys, and the tally of a knitted row, if girls. As he warmed to his self-appointed task, Skarm found that Estrella thought differently from the other children. He had been conceived, born, and raised apart from the community, but there was more than just the sum of these differences that distinguished him from those of his own age. Skarm saw curiosity and intelligence on the first day of school, but when the first class was over, he looked out his window and saw a circle of boys teasing Estrella, who struggled to follow his mother's wish that he refrain from fighting.
"Don't your ma make you wash your hair?"
Knowing that any answer would make them laugh, Estrella compressed his lips and said nothing, which made them sure that he thought them stupid, which made them resentful. They soon tired of repeating the question and found another.
"Well, eyes like yours, does everything look green to you?"
Skarm recognized Estrella's dilemma. As he watched unseen, Estrella did not reply, which meant that they laughed anyway. The more he avoided them, the more they persisted, and the more unpleasant grew the questions.
You as ugly as your dad.
Estrella's face set into a scowl, and Skarm guessed what would happen next.
Why'd your ma have a stranger's son? She stupid or weird or what?
Then the fighting began. They took turns, but because Estrella was lean and light and outnumbered, he was the one who suffered most. He lost that day, but the next? Skarm supplemented Estrella's schooling with private instruction in wrestling, blocks, holds, and throws. Estrella was unexpectedly apt, learning how to use his skill and speed to overcome their strength. Perhaps because fighting distressed his mother, maybe out of something that he found in himself, Estrella perfected the art of inflicting a stalemate on his oppressors. As time went on, none of the village boys was willing to try a fall with Estrella, because though he never won a wrestling bout, he also never lost. Something in his nature or upbringing kept him from triumphing over another person. The villagers found this reticence beyond strange. They understood fights where one won and another lost. They had no words for a third outcome. If Skarm spent more time with Estrella's education than with the other boys, it was not only out of a duty to the man he had saved, but also because the boy had a hunger to learn, the like of which seldom affected the youth of the village. Estrella mastered the basic skills faster than the other young people of his age, and when they left Skarm's tutelage, all of them convinced that they were adequately schooled, Estrella was unsatisfied. He consumed the few texts from which he was taught, and when he asked for more, Skarm introduced him to his private hoard of books preserved from before, cautioning him that some of the villagers would burn them, as their grandfathers and great-grandfathers had done. Estrella learned the clean logic of mathematics, but he was captivated by stories of brave men who had amazing adventures on land and sea and who won the hearts of beautiful women. The combination of logic and romance distanced Estrella from the young people of the village and made him long for nameless places. Elsewhere, he called them, though he never used the word to anyone. Elsewhere, for Estrella, held exactly the opposite feelings that the villagers attributed to before and away, those places and times about which their forefathers had deliberately forgotten. Estrella's elsewhere was a land of heart's desire, all the more attractive for the fact that he knew in the logical part of his mind that its perfection could not possibly exist. Estrella knew that the tales from before came from a time deliberately forgotten. He learned not to ask questions of villagers who did not speak or think about a long past age, when ships had traded all manner of things and ideas, and people had traveled to and from the village. Skarm let Estrella discover that long ago the villagers had rejected the outside world, thrown away everything that reminded them of it, and thereby frozen themselves in time along with their descendants. Estrella tried to understand what Skarm told him of their anger at being abandoned, but he tempered his criticisms when Skarm spoke of the way that the villagers' ignorance and superstition were balanced by their courage, loyalty, and steadfastness. When Estrella turned his attention to away, asking Skarm about what was over the horizon, in particular where his father had come from, the old man was less helpful, both because he knew so little, and also because he was not sure about the truth of what Estrella's father had told him. Neither Alana nor Skarm could or would answer Estrella's questions about the world beyond the horizon from which his father had come. As he grew, he still respected both of them, but he also became aggrieved at their reticence. When it began to matter to Estrella that girls were different from boys by more than the length of their hair and the fact that they wore skirts instead of breeks, shepherds visited the village. Each autumn, for as long as he could remember, he had seen one or two men come down from the mountains carrying bales of wool on their shoulders to sell to the village women. This time a group of three, clearly a family, arrived at Alana's door early one morning when the wild geese were strung out across a wind-swept autumn sky. When Alana opened the door, Estrella stared at three faces he had never seen before, and they stared back. The man was stooped under a huge bale of wool, his face almost invisible under a shapeless leather hat. His wife beside him had a smaller load that allowed her to hold her head higher, showing a pleasant face darkened by wind, weather, and travel. The face of the girl beside her caught and held Estrella's attention. Villagers' faces were oval, their heads roughly egg-shaped, whereas hers was round, with a wide forehead and high cheekbones. She returned his stare out of large brown eyes, that looked out between strands of dark, travel-tangled hair held by a leather ribbon above her black eyebrows. As the focus of Estrella's eyes widened to take in the rest of her, he blushed to notice that the fastenings on her leather vest did not entirely close, revealing the hollow between her breasts.
"Lamb's wool for your spinning wheel," said the man,
his voice slow and deep, like someone who spoke seldom. "Enter, rest, and we will speak of what we may exchange," said Alanna politely. The three looked first at her and then at each other, surprised by her hospitality, which was not what they had usually encountered from the other villagers. The girl's brown eyes swiftly returned to Estrella. They all sat down at Alana's table and bargained her completed cloth garments for their raw wool. The woman was entranced by the excellence of Alana's needlework, caressing the garments with her fingers as her man frowned, lest her enthusiasm lessen his chances in the bargaining. Meanwhile, the girl's eyes did not leave Estrella's face. Her lips were slightly parted, giving Estrella a glimpse of white teeth and the tip of her tongue. When he asked whether her home was far from the village, she nodded and went on staring at him. When he held the plate of Alana's cookies towards her, she solemnly took one and ate it, still regarding him without changing her expression. Unnerved by this attention, Estrella could think of nothing to say, so he sat, uncomfortably stealing glances at her, unable to wrench his attention away. At last the bargaining was over. Alana shook hands with the shepherd, and they parted, he with a handful of coins, his wife with a blouse and a skirt. Both she and the couple smiled their satisfaction. The girl and Estrella continued to stare at each other until the three shepherds took up their packs and went on down the path to try their luck on the rest of the village, leaving Alana and Estrella with a pile of wool to sort, wash, and dry. Unnoticed by Estrella, Alana had seen how the girl's eyes had locked onto his, and she sadly recognized that she would no longer be the only female presence in his life. That she had long known this would happen some day did not make the end of Estrella's childhood any easier for her to bear. For the rest of that day, and for many after it, Estrella's thoughts were in turmoil whenever he thought of the girl. Even though he had seen her for only a few short moments, he had been ready to go with the girl to the mountains, to the place where the outcasts lived, shunned by the village. He was shocked by the impulse, because it would have meant the end of all his hopes to sail with the village fleet. As time went by, he was no longer disturbed by his moment of irrationality. However, out of the encounter came a resolution that none of the village girls would ever steal away his ability to think, as had the nameless girl from the high country. But he still cherished the memory of when their stares had gone far beyond mere looking, and from then on he no longer cared so much about being excluded from the community in which he lived. He had a conviction that even if there was no real elsewhere, he would some day find his own somewhere, and perhaps someone who would understand. Eventually the village boys' voices deepened and hair grew on their cheeks and chins. Estrella had learned to jig for squid, cut bait, salt and dry the catch, row or sail a dory, and tend main and jib sheets aboard a village fishing boat as handily as the boys of his own age. He had also learned how to work with them, despite their ridicule and derision. Though he hated being called blackhead, outsider, or stranger, he also felt a fierce pride in being his own self, whatever they thought and said. He had grown up among the villagers, but he was not one of them, and everyone knew it. So ends the prologue of The Voyage South by Seymour Hamilton. If you'd like to hear more, drop me an email at spiderweb.com, and if Captain Hamilton has no objection, mayhap I'll return to Estrella and, God help me, a future cod past. Back when a benefit concert for Jeannie was thrown here on Bowen Island, Tony Dominelli was the first cat on stage, and I've never forgotten that. Tony and his kick-ass bar band, the Rolling Stallones, will be among the headliners at Terry's Bowen Island benefit, and it chances that he has also just released his long-awaited first album, Dominelli, on CD, which is on sale at several locations on Bowen and can be downloaded by visiting tonydominelli.bandcamp.com. It's Tony, T-O-N-Y, Dominelli, D-O-M-I-N-E-L-L-I. .bandcamp.com. With typical outlandish generosity, Tony has chosen to donate its income up until May 26th to Terry. So the least I can do is swivel a sample on you, a wisely written and well-sung song that could have been written any time in the past century or the one to come. It's called All That Really Matters.
There's a strange and foreign people living all around among us, and they see us just the same way, with their stranger eyes upon us. But deep inside we're much the same. We all need love and we all have pain. So when you think your luck is down, take a good look all around. Tell me all that really matters. Tell me all that really matters. Isn't love what really matters? All that really matters in the end. You can send away your elders to a place you'll rarely see them, and pretend that they won't need you, and pretend that you won't need them. But deep inside we're much the same. We all need love and we all have pain. Do we have to be reminded? How long have we been blinded? And it's not a matter of who's right or wrong. It's much too late when they are gone. Tell me all that really matters. Tell me all that really matters. Isn't love what really matters? All that really matters in the end.
Done now. But before I let you go, I want to lay a few more words on you that are not my own on the subject of healing. They come from my favorite orator, the late, great Lord Buckley. I recently had the great good fortune to fall into correspondence with His Lordship's son, Crown Prince Richard. One of my very proudest possessions is now a formal certificate of royalty I'm having framed, which proclaims me to be, quote, Prince Spider Robinson of the Royal Court of His Royal Highness Lord Richard Buckley, unquote, dated February 21st, 2012, and signed personally by Crown Prince Richard Buckley. It don't get much cooler than that. Lord Richard Buckley began performing as an MC at dance marathons in the Chicago Coliseum in the mid-1930s, and by the early 40s he had his own club and was said to be Al Capone's favorite act. By the 50s he was already a legend, taking the stage in a tuxedo and a pith helmet, addressing his audience in a patently fraudulent British accent as "My Lords and My Ladies of the Royal Court," and performing raps in hipster, the language of jazz, in honor of his own personal saints, people like Mahatma Gandhi, whom he called the Hip Gand,
or the Naz, a carpenter kitty from Nazareth who had them pretty eyes and wanted everybody to see out his eyes so they could see how pretty it was. By 1960, alas, he was gone at 54, his death arguably attributable in part to the seizure of his cabaret card, without which he could not perform. Crown Prince Richard has lately been working genuine miracles in getting his father's work back out there, producing and releasing quite a number of new CDs of magnificent Lord Buckley recordings, either many decades out of print, or in some cases never before in print. They can all now be found and purchased or downloaded as MP3 from CDBaby.com, and I have them all, and one and all they are the Bend and End, the Genuine Dromedary's Drawers, and the Welk's Kneecap. Back at the beginning of this podcast, I briefly quoted his lordship, an excerpt from a letter written, according to him, to King Ferdinand I of Spain from the New World by one of his most remarkable warriors, Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, the Gasser. Lord Buckley recorded several different, in some cases even conflicting versions of that rap, but this is my own particular favorite because it gives you a good sense of the kind of relationship his lordship could create with an audience using only his speaking voice. It comes from the CD The Tales of Lord Buckley, Professor of Hippology, presented here by kind permission of His Highness the Crown Prince. And it brings this podcast full circle by returning us to the subject of miraculous healing, albeit 502 years ago. So this goes out to my remarkable daughter, Terry Luana Robinson da Silva, her husband Jaron, and their daughter Marissa.
Harold Morales and ladies, to give to the movement the scene of the Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca. He's a soldier for Ferdinand I of Spain, and he was sent to the New World after Bullion, and he flipped. He said to you, in order to know what it means to have nothing, you must have nothing! And that's what he had in spades. Through the story, he gave me the knowledge of the healing of the hand. And I want you to dig it deeply and get your key. I just to straighten it out a little bit for you. He met an Indian chief who was starving to death. They were starving to death. He said, they thought he was a white god. So they said, we'll be very happy to help you if you straighten out the chief's boyfriend. He said, no problem. He looked like he was going to sit in the dog with his back to the street and, you know, just turn him around. So he didn't know anything about making an appeal. But he fell back on his knees and he made a connection that shook the peninsula. I'm telling you. He moved him. And here's the way it goes down here. Now, you heard about Vasco da Gama, the island bumper. He was a history cat with a big fast pressing. He'll say, the Gama bump island number one, boom, put it in the book. The Gama bump island number two, boom, put it in the book. But there was another cat jumped at the same time and had a lean crustacean that cut his first cap to shreds. And they call him Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, the Gasser. And he was a warrior stud for Ferdinand I of Spain. And Ferdinand I of Spain was a balling king. He likes to see the juice drinking and the good time going and the chicks jumping. And he's can-on cat all the time. He's the kind of a stud to stick his wig out of the castle window in the early bright and say, look at Prince Liberty this morning. She looked pretty cuckoo today. He said, give that chick another castle. I say, we ain't got no more castles, Your Majesty. He say, build her one. Don't stand there like an idiot. As a consequence, he was a little short of cash. So it was Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, the Gasser's misfortune to go with the square captain on the three-ship convoy, ran into a short tilt on the far side and blew the whole gig on the beach in Florida in 1510. And Florida in 1510 was Crocodile City. You couldn't sit stupid stop. It's snap, snap, snapping all over the place. And every bug in the jungle is dive-bombing these bull cats. And the ones that ain't dive-bombing is hitchhiking rides on them. And they're beat, bent, flop, trapped, and de-gigged. It's what you don't know what that means. That means no job. It's a pretty bad thing, you know that. So it was Alva Nunez, Cabeza de Vaca, the gasser, a buddy cat, and the maw, and the parrot. And the parrot had the best go the whole lake. He had that feather overcoat. The other poor studs didn't even have a Union Oil map, but they went stomping down the beach. They didn't know where they was going, but they knew where they was, wasn't it? So to show you how hung up they was, they stomped all over Texas. Then they turned around and stomped all the way to North Dakota in 1510. And then they turned around and stomped all the way to Mexico City. When he got to Mexico City, Alvar Nunez, Cabeza de Vaca, the gasser, sat down to knock a note on Ferdinand I, to hit him where he'd been goofing all this time. Only took him 8 years. Little Sunday afternoon flip, you know. So he says, Your Majesty is writing a letter. He said, I've suffered from pavement rash. He said, I've been billed, willed, and twilled. He said, I've been flung, whined, and looned. He said, I've been hung up and jammed up and framed up and backed up and stacked up and macked up and racked up. But he said, I'll never dug no jazz like this last riff you put me on. He said, my buddy Cass and me was in such a sad bind, we were breathing in stock hollow to keep the pilot light lit. He said, just about ready to give up the whole gig, and they ran into Indian village. Gasser said, well, I'll go in here and sound the chief and get a couple of buckets of acorn. Say, we might not find out where we is, but we'll be able to find out who we is. That'll help a little bit. Say, no sooner got that out, and here come the chief. Says, ah, me say, your big god, me know. You come big ship, he got white wing, he go sky. Good you come, you got good miracle wing. Me got buddy cat, he have little couple 17 crocodile. Okay, you good, you miracle wing, you got big wing. You fix him up, put him on his feet. Me give you a couple of buckets of acorn, maybe 2 or 3 straw, okay? He ain't even slipped the cat in the disco up to now. And the cat that he's asking to get straightened out is in very delicate condition indeed. He's not on the razor's edge. He's on the horn of the stone. But they didn't call him Alvar Nunez Cabeza de Vaca the gasser for nothing. He fell down on his knees and he said, Lord, this is Alvar Nunez Cabeza de Vaca the gasser, son to you, Lord. No use in looking for me in the book. You won't find me there, Lord. I've been blown from Ferdinand the First to another part of the field, Lord. He said, I know that you're busy. I can see your switchboard is lit up with calls all over the world. Help me here, stay me this, do that. He said, I wouldn't be sounding you now, Lord, if I wasn't in such a serious bind, Lord. But if you do me this little favor, Lord, and state not the chief buddy cat, Lord, though I've never blown a note for you before in my life, Lord, you've got yourself a boy. He looked around the corner of his eyes. I had a tough run up that ladder, didn't I? He looked around the corner of his eyes and saw the man he was praying for stand and said, what time do we eat? And he blew about 200 beautiful miracles right across the land. There was even one stud under a rug for 4 days. Put the gasser on him, blew him out. This is history. Dig this jazz. And it's beautiful jazz. And Alvar Nunez Cabeza de Vaca, the gasser, said at the end of the letter, said right at the end of his letter, he said, Your Majesty, I'm hipped at your great swinging king with a fat book. He said, I want to knock a page on it. He said, I found out on this expedition that there is a great power within that when used in beauty and immaculate purity can cure and heal and cause miracles. And he said, when you use it, it spreads like a magic garden And when you do not use it, it recedes from you. Alba Nunez, que beza de baca, the gasa, 1500 and leaping 10.
A lot of you sent healing energy to my daughter in one form and another, and I appreciate it. Maybe it made all the difference. How would I know? I'm sure it didn't hurt. Now that I have that off my mind for a while, I will try to emit podcasts a bit more regularly again in the weeks ahead. Thanks for your patience and understanding and generosity during the past few months. Be well.